It's important that you address the behavior right away. Otherwise, they won't understand why they are being disciplined. We actually don't think this is bad advice if you are running a behavioral conditioning lab with animals. For mice or even dogs, it's good advice. For human beings, not so much. The fact is that there are times when it does make sense to address misbehavior right away. However, it's frequently the case that the absolute worst time to address a misbehavior is immediately after it's occurred. The reason is simple. Misbehavior often happens because a child isn't able to regulate his big feelings. And when his emotions are dysregulated, his upstairs brain has gone offline. It's temporarily out of order, meaning he's not able to accomplish the tasks his upstairs brain is responsible for. Making good decisions, thinking about others, considering consequences, balancing his emotions and body, and being a receptive learner. So, yes, we do recommend that you address a behavioral issue fairly soon when possible, but only when your child is in a calm and receptive state of mind, even if you need to wait. Even children as young as 3 can remember what happened in recent history, including the day before. You can begin that conversation by saying, "I'd like to talk to you about what happened yesterday at bedtime. That didn't go so well, did it?" Waiting for the right time is essential when it comes to teaching effectively. So let's go back to the suggestion we made in Chapter 4. Once you've connected and you're wondering whether it's time to move into the redirection phase, ask yourself one simple question. Is my child ready? Ready to hear? Ready to learn? Ready to understand? If the answer is no, then there's no reason to try to redirect in that moment. Most likely, more connection is called for. Or, especially for older kids, you may just need to give them some time and space before they'll be ready to hear you. When we talk to educators, we often explain that there's an optimal window or sweet spot for teaching. If students' nervous systems are what we call under-aroused, because they are sleepy, bored, or checked out for some other reason, then they are in an unreceptive state, meaning the students won't be able to learn effectively. And the opposite is just as bad. If students' nervous systems are over-aroused, meaning they feel anxious or stressed out, or their bodies are hyperactive with lots of motor activity and movement, that also produces an unreceptive state when it's difficult for them to learn. Instead, we need to create an environment that helps them move into a state of mind that's calm, alert, and receptive. That's the sweet spot where learning really takes place. That's the moment they're ready to learn. It's the same with our kids. When their nervous systems are under or over aroused, they won't be nearly as receptive to what we want to teach them. So when we discipline, we want to wait until they are calm, alert, and receptive. Ask yourself, is my child ready? Even after you've connected and soothed your child's negative state, it still might be best to wait for a time later in the day, or even the next day, to find a better moment for the explicit teaching and redirection. You can even say, "I'd like to wait until we're really able to talk and listen to each other. We'll come back and talk about it in a while." As a side note, just as it's important to ask, "Is my child ready?" it's also important to ask yourself, "Am I ready?" If you are in a reactive state of mind, it's best to wait to have the conversation. You can't be an effective teacher if you're not in a calm and collected state. If you're too upset to remain in control, you're likely to approach the whole interaction in a way that's counterproductive to your goals of teaching and building connection. In that case, it's often better to say something like, "I'm too angry to have a helpful conversation right now, so I'm going to take some time to calm down, and then we'll talk in a bit." Then, once you are both ready, Discipline will be more effective and feel better to both of you. Principle number 2. Be consistent, but not rigid. There's no question about it. Consistency is crucial when it comes to raising and disciplining our children. Many parents we see in our offices realize that they need to work on being more consistent with their kids, whether it's with bedtimes, limiting junk food or media, or just in general. But there are other parents who place such a high priority on consistency that it becomes a rigidity that's not good for their kids, themselves, or the parent-child relationship. Let's get clear on the difference between the two terms. Consistency means working from a reliable and coherent philosophy so that our kids know what we expect of them and what they should expect from us. Rigidity, on the other hand, means maintaining an unswerving devotion to rules we've set up, sometimes without having even thought them through or without changing them as our kids develop. As parents, we want to be consistent, but not rigid. Kids obviously need consistency. They need to know what our expectations are and how we will respond if they break or even bend agreed-upon rules. Your reliability teaches them about what to expect in their world. More than that, it helps them feel safe. They know they can count on you to be constant and steady, even when their internal or external world is chaotic. This kind of predictable, sensitive, attuned care is actually what builds secure attachment. It lets us provide our kids with what's called safe containment, since they have a secure base and clear boundaries to help guide them when their emotions are exploding. Limits you set are like the guardrails on the Golden Gate Bridge. For a child, living without clear boundaries is as anxiety-provoking as driving over that bridge without guardrails to stop you from plummeting into San Francisco Bay. But rigidity is not about safety or reliability. It's about stubbornness. It keeps parents from compromising when necessary, or looking at context and the intention behind a behavior, or recognizing the moments when it's reasonable to make an exception. One of the main reasons parents become rigid with their children is because they are practicing a form of fear-based parenting. They worry that if they ever give in and allow a soft drink at one meal, they'll create a slippery slope and their kids will be drinking Mountain Dew for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the rest of their lives. So they stick to their guns and deny the soft drink. Or their 6-year-old has a nightmare and wants to climb into bed with them because he's scared, but they worry that they'll be setting a dangerous precedent. They say, "We don't want him to develop bad sleep habits. If we don't nip it in the bud right now, he'll be a bad sleeper his whole childhood." So they stick to their guns and dutifully send him back to his bed. We understand the fear. We felt it ourselves in regard to our own kids. And we agree that parents should definitely remain aware of whatever patterns they are setting up for their children. That's why consistency is so important. But when fear-based parenting leads us to believe that we can never make an exception about a treat, or that we can't comfort or nurture our frightened child in the middle of the night without damning him to a life of sleeplessness, then we've moved into rigidity. That's parenting based on fear, not on what our child needs in that particular moment. That's parenting with a goal of reducing our own anxiety and fears rather than what will best teach our child's emerging mind and mold the developing brain. So how do we maintain consistency without crossing over to fear-based rigidity? Well, let's start by acknowledging that there are some non-negotiables. For instance, under no circumstances can you let your toddler run through a busy parking lot, or your school-age child swim without supervision, or your teenager get into a car with a driver who's been drinking. Physical safety is non-negotiable. However, that doesn't mean you can't ever make exceptions or even turn a blind eye from time to time when your child misbehaves. For instance, if you have a rule about no technology at the dinner table, but your 4-year-old has just received a new electronic puzzle game that he'll play with quietly while you have dinner with another couple, that might be a good time to make an exception to your rule. Or, if your daughter has promised that she'll finish her homework before dinner, but her grandparents show up to take her on an outing, you might negotiate a new deal with her. So, for example, a rigid response in that situation would be that you say, "Sorry, I know your grandparents are here, but our rule is homework before dinner." Rather, you could try a consistent but flexible response, which might go something like this. "Since your grandparents are here, you can wait on your homework. When do you think would be the best time to get it done?" The goal, in other words, is to maintain a consistent but flexible approach with your kids, so that they know what to expect from you, but they also know that at times you will thoughtfully consider all the factors involved. It goes back to what we talked about in the previous chapter, response flexibility. We want to intentionally respond to a situation in a way that considers what works best for our child and for our family, even if that means making an exception to our normal rules and expectations. The question when it comes to consistent versus rigid discipline is what we're hoping to accomplish. Again, what do we want to teach? Under normal circumstances, we want to consistently maintain our rules and expectations. But we want to avoid being rigid, ignoring context, and thus missing out on the chance to teach the lessons we want to teach. Sometimes when we discipline, we need to look for other ways to accomplish our goals, so we can more effectively teach what we want our kids to learn. At times, for example, you might try a do-over. Instead of immediately offering a punishment for speaking disrespectfully, you can say something like, "I bet if you tried again, you could come up with a more respectful way to say that." Do-overs allow a child a second chance to handle a situation well. It gives them practice doing the right thing. You're still consistently maintaining your expectations, but you're doing so in a way that's often much more beneficial than a rigidly imposed, unrelated consequence. After all, skill development is a huge part of what discipline is all about, and that requires repeated guidance and coaching. If you were coaching your child's soccer team and she was having trouble kicking the ball straight, you wouldn't give her consequences for every time she shanked it. Instead, you'd give her more practice so that she gets better and better at kicking it where she wants it to go. You'd want her to have a clear, familiar feeling of what it's like to hit the ball square and watch it sail into the goal. In the same way, when our kids behave in ways that don't meet the expectations we've set up, sometimes the best thing we can do is to have them practice behaving in ways that do meet our expectations. Another way to encourage skill building is to have your child come up with a creative response. As much as we wish it did, saying "I'm sorry" doesn't actually fix the broken fairy wand that was thrown in anger. An apology note and using allowance money to buy a new wand might teach more and help develop skills related to decision-making and empathy. The point is that in your efforts to build skills, you can still be consistent while remaining flexible and open to other alternatives. As kids learn about right and wrong, they also need to learn that life is not just about external reward and punishment. Flexibility, problem-solving, considering context, and fixing our mistakes are also important. Most important is for children to understand the lesson at hand with as much personal insight as they are developmentally capable of, and to empathize with anybody they've hurt, then figure out how to respond to the situation and prevent it in the future. In other words, there's a lot about morality that we want to teach our kids in addition to knowing right from wrong. We don't want to be their traffic cop, following them around, telling them when to stop and when to go, and giving them tickets when they break the law. Wouldn't it be much better to teach them how to drive responsibly and give them the skills, tools, and practice to make good decisions on their own? To do this successfully, sometimes we need to be open to seeing the gray areas, not just the black and white. We need to make decisions based not on an arbitrary rule we've previously set down, but on what's best for our kids and our family right now, in this particular situation. Consistent, yes, but not rigid. 3 Mindsight Outcomes. So 1-2-3 discipline focuses on one definition, teaching, and 2 principles, wait until your child is ready, and be consistent but not rigid. Now, let's look at the 3 outcomes we're looking to achieve when we redirect. If you've read The Whole Brain Child, you're already familiar with the term mindsight, which I coined and discuss at length in my books Mindsight and Brainstorm. Explained most simply, mindsight is the ability to see our own mind, as well as the mind of another. It allows us to develop meaningful relationships while also maintaining a healthy and independent sense of self. When we ask our children to consider their own feelings using personal insight, while also imagining how someone else might experience a particular situation using empathy, we are helping them develop mindsight. Mindsight also involves the process of integration, which we discussed earlier. You'll remember that integration occurs when separate things become linked, like the right and left sides of the brain or 2 people in a relationship. When integration does not occur, chaos or rigidity results. So when a relationship experiences an inevitable rupture in how we honor each other's differences, or when we don't link compassionately to each other, that's a break in integration. One example of creating integration is when we repair such a rupture. If you find that chaos or rigidity is popping up in your connection with your kids, repair is in order. We can take steps to repair the situation and make things right when we've made a bad decision or hurt someone with our words or actions. Let's discuss each of these mindsight outcomes, insight, empathy, and integration or repair, individually. Outcome number 1, insight. One of the best outcomes of redirection as part of a no-drama discipline strategy is that it helps develop personal insight in our children. The reason is that instead of simply commanding and demanding that our kids meet our expectations, we ask them to notice and reflect on their own feelings and their responses to difficult situations. This can be difficult, as you know, since a child's upstairs brain is not only the last to develop, but it is often offline in disciplinary moments. But with practice and insight-building conversations, like the ones we've been discussing and will explain at greater length in the next chapter, children can become more aware and understand themselves more fully. They can develop personal mindsight that allows them to better understand what they're feeling and have more control over how they respond in difficult situations. For young children, we might facilitate this process simply by naming the emotions we observe. When she took away the doll, it looked like you felt really mad. Is that right? For older kids, open-ended questions are better, even if we have to lead the witness towards self-understanding. I was watching you just before you blew up at your brother, and it looked like you were getting more and more annoyed that he was badgering you. Is that what you were feeling? The hope is that his response is something like, "Yeah, and it makes me so mad when he..." Every time a child gets specific and discusses his own emotional experience, he gains more insight into himself and deepens his own self-understanding. That's a reflective conversation that cultivates mindsight. And such a focus on his insight can help him move toward the second desired outcome of redirection. Outcome number 2, empathy. Along with developing insight into themselves, we want our kids to develop the other aspect of mindsight, empathy. The science of neuroplasticity teaches us that repeated practice of this reflection, as in our reflective dialogues with others, activates our mind-sight circuitry. And with repeated focus of attention on our inner mental life, it also changes the wiring in the brain and builds and strengthens the empathic, other-centered part of the upstairs brain, what scientists call the social engagement circuitry of the prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that makes mind-sight maps not only of ourselves for insight and of others for empathy, but also of we for morality and mutual understanding. That's what mind-sight circuits create. So we want to give kids lots of practice reflecting on how their actions impact others, seeing things from another's point of view, and developing awareness of others' feelings. One example might go like this. If someone is upset and your child is observing that, you might say to her something like this. See Juliana's tears? Can you imagine how she might be feeling? Simply asking questions and helping our children make observations like these will be much more effective than preaching sermons, delivering lectures, or giving consequences. The human brain is capable of extending itself in a way that allows us to comprehend the experiences of the people around us, and even sense our connections as part of a we that develops with them. That's how we experience not only empathy, but the important sense of our interconnectedness, the integrated state that is the basis of moral imagination, thinking, and action. So the more we give our kids practice at considering how someone else feels or experiences a situation, the more empathic and caring they will become. And as these circuits of insight and empathy develop, they naturally set the foundation for morality, our inner sense of being not only differentiated, but linked into a larger whole. That's integration. Or another situation where two boys are fighting with each other might go something like this. Did you see his face when you yelled at him? That must have been really tough for him, knowing how much he idolizes you. Outcome number 3, integration and the repair of ruptures. After helping our kids to consider their own feelings and then reflect on how their actions impacted others, we want to ask them what they can do to create integration as they repair the situation and make things right. Which part of the brain do we appeal to now? You guessed it, the upstairs brain, with its responsibility for empathy, morality, considering the consequences of our decisions, and controlling emotions. We appeal to the upstairs brain by asking questions, as in the previous cases about repairing a situation. What can you do to make it right? What positive step can you take to help fix this? What do you think needs to happen now? Repair builds on insight and empathy to then move to the mindset map of we, as a connection is reestablished with the other person. Once we've led our children toward empathy and insight, we want to aim for the outcome of taking actions to address not only the situation their behavior has impacted, but also the other person and, ultimately, the relationship itself. Taking action after hurting someone or making a bad decision isn't easy for any of us, including our kids, especially when children are little or if they have a particularly shy temperament. Parents may need to support them and help them with their apology. Sometimes it's fine for the parent to actually deliver the apology for the child. You too can agree on the message beforehand. After all, not much good comes from forcing a child to offer an inauthentic apology when he's not yet ready, or forcing him to apologize when doing so is going to flood his nervous system with anxiety. It comes back to asking whether your child is ready. Sometimes we have to wait for a child to be in the right frame of mind. It's never easy to go back and try to make up for a mistake, but no drama discipline allows us to help kids learn to do so. It aims at achieving these 3 outcomes: focusing on giving our children practice at better understanding themselves with insight, seeing things from the perspective of others with empathy, then taking steps to improve a particular situation when they've done something wrong. When children deepen their ability to know themselves, consider the feelings of others, and take action toward repairing a situation, they build and strengthen connections within the frontal lobe, which allows them to better know themselves and get along with others as they move into adolescence and adulthood. Basically, you are teaching your child's brain how to make mindsight maps of me, you, and we. 1, 2, 3 discipline in action. Life gives us opportunity after opportunity to build the brain. That's what we saw when Roger talked to his daughter about monopolizing her sister's playdate. He could have easily called out to his daughter something like, "Allie, why don't you give Katie and Gina some time to themselves?" In doing so, though, he would have missed an opportunity to teach Allie and help build her brain. His response, instead, offered a 1-2-3 approach. By initiating a conversation with his daughter, "Do you see that Katie isn't happy?" rather than laying down the law, he focused on the one definition of discipline, teaching. He also worked from the two key principles. First, he made sure his daughter was ready by making her feel listened to without judgment. "I totally agree that it's not your fault." And second, he avoided being overly rigid and even asked Allie for help in coming up with a good response to the situation. And he achieved the three outcomes, helping his daughter think about her own actions. Why do you think she might be upset? Her sister's feelings. If she were standing here and told us how she felt, what would she say? And what response she could take to best respond as an integrative repair to the situation. Let's come up with a plan. The approach works with older children as well. Let's look at an example of how one couple applied it with their middle schooler. At every major gift-giving occasion over the past year, Nyla had consistently written the phrase "cell phone" at the top of her wish list. She repeatedly told her parents, Steve and Bella, that all the other kids had phones. Her mom and dad held out longer than many of their friends, but when she turned 12, they relented. After all, Nyla was reasonably responsible. She was spending more time independently from her parents, and a phone would make things more convenient for everyone. They took all the measures they knew were important, disabling the phone's internet capabilities, downloading apps that would filter out dangerous content, talking with her about issues like privacy and security, then moved on to this next phase in their parenting lives. During the first few months, Nyla made her parents' decision look good. She kept track of the phone and used it appropriately, and they learned that they hadn't overestimated the convenience factor. But one night, Bella heard Nyla coughing an hour after lights out, so she opened the door to her room to check on her. The blue glow hovering over Nyla's bed instantly disappeared, but it was obviously too late. She was busted. Bella flipped on the overhead light, and before she could say anything, Nyla hurried to explain. "Mom, I was worried about the test and couldn't sleep, so I was just trying to get my mind on something else." Bella knew better than to overreact, especially when her primary goal in that moment was to get her daughter back to sleep. So she first connected. "I can understand needing to get your mind on something else. I hate it when I can't sleep." Then she simply said, "But let's talk about it tomorrow. Hand me the phone, and I want you to go right to sleep." When Bella told Steve, she learned that he had had a similar interaction with Nyla just the previous week when Bella was gone, and he'd forgotten to mention it. So now they had two cases of their daughter blatantly disregarding rules about cell phone usage and sleep. Taking a 1-2-3 approach, Steve and Bella focused on the one definition of discipline. What lesson did they want to teach here? They wanted to emphasize the importance of honesty, responsibility, trust, and following the rules the family members have all agreed to. As they considered how to respond to Nyla's infractions, they kept this definition front and center in their minds. Then, they focused on the two principles. Bella demonstrated the first one, making sure her daughter was ready, when she simply took Nyla's phone and asked her to go to sleep. Late at night, when everyone is tired and a child is up later than she should be, is rarely the best time to teach a lesson. Lecturing Nyla right then would have likely turned into all kinds of drama, leaving both mother and daughter frustrated and angry. Not exactly a recipe for going right to sleep or teaching a lesson either. The better strategy was to wait for the next day, when Bella and Steve could find the right moment to address the issue. Not during the morning rush to eat breakfast and make lunches, but after dinner, when everyone could discuss the issue calmly and from a fresh perspective. As for their specific response, this is where the second principle came in. Be consistent, but not rigid. Consistency is, of course, crucial. Steve and Bella had taken a clear stance about the importance of Nyla being honest and responsible with her phone. And at least in this instance, she hadn't lived up to their agreement. So they needed to address that lapse with a consistent response. But in doing so, they didn't want to make a rigid, snap decision that overshot the mark. Their first reaction was to take the phone away altogether. But once they talked and calmer heads prevailed, they recognized that in this case, that response would be too drastic. Outside of this one problem, Nyla had acted responsibly with her phone. So rather than taking it away, they decided to discuss the issue with Nyla, asking for her help, coming up with policies to address the situation. In fact, she was the one who came up with a fix that was easy for everyone. She would leave her phone outside her room when she goes to bed. Then she wouldn't be tempted to check it every time it lit up, and Mom and Dad could be assured that Nyla was recharging while her phone was as well. This response made sense given Nyla's general good decision-making. They all agreed that if more problems arose, or if she demonstrated more extreme misuse of the phone, Steve and Bella would hold on to the phone except for certain prescribed times of the day. With this response, which respected Nyla enough to work with her and collaborate while still enforcing boundaries, Steve and Bella presented a consistent, united front that adhered to their rules and expectations without becoming rigid and disciplining in ways that wouldn't benefit their daughter, the situation, or their relationship with her. As a result, they gave themselves a much better chance at achieving their three desired outcomes: insight, empathy, and integrated repair. They helped encourage insight in their daughter by the collaborative approach they took in asking questions and engaging in dialogue. The questions focused on helping Nyla pause and think about her decision to power up her phone when she wasn't supposed to. How do you feel inside when you're doing something you know you shouldn't? Or when we walk in and see you on your phone, what do you think we feel about it? Other questions led to insight into better options in the future. The next time you're having trouble sleeping, what could you do instead of being on your phone? With questions like these, Nyla's parents helped increase her personal insight and build her upstairs brain, allowing her to develop an internal compass and become more insightful in the future. Plus, by approaching the issue in a way that respected her and her desires, they increased the chances that Nyla will come and talk with them about even bigger issues later as she enters her teen years. The empathy outcome in this situation is different from certain other discipline moments. Often, when we encourage empathy in our children when they've made a bad decision, we try to lead them to think about the feelings of someone else who was hurt because of their behavior. In this case, no one was really harmed except for Nyla herself, who lost some sleep. But Steve and Bella tried to lead her to understand that their trust in her had been dented, at least a bit. They knew better than to over-dramatize the issue or stoop to using guilt trips or self-pity, and they explicitly communicated to her that they weren't going to resort to these tactics. But they talked with her about how much their relationship with her means and explained that it doesn't feel good when broken trust harms that relationship in any way. This part of the discussion about the relationship is a focus on integration, the connection of different parts. Integration is what makes the whole greater than the sum of its parts, and it's what creates love in a relationship. Focusing on insight and empathy, and then on their relationship, thus led naturally to the third desired integrative outcome, repair. Once a breach in a relationship has been created, no matter how small, we want to repair it as soon as possible. Nyla's parents needed to give her that chance. In their discussion about what policies to put in place about late-night cell phone use, they asked questions that helped her think about the relational effects of not following through on commitments. Again, they avoided manipulating her emotionally by making her feel guilty, and instead asked good faith questions like, "What's something you could do to help us feel good about the trust we have in you?" They had to lead the witness a bit, helping Nyla think about trust-building action she could take, like using her phone to just call and check in with her parents from time to time, or leaving it outside her room at night without having to be asked. In doing so, she thought about ways she could be intentional in rebuilding her parents' trust in her. Notice that this issue with Nyla falls into the category of typical behaviors that parents have to deal with on a daily basis. At times, there are behavioral challenges where it can be helpful to involve professionals. More extreme behaviors that are difficult to handle and that last for longer periods of time can sometimes be a sign that something else is going on. If your child frequently experiences intense emotional reactivity that does not respond to repair efforts, it can be helpful to talk with a pediatric psychotherapist or child development specialist who can supportively explore the situation with you to see whether you and your child could benefit from some intervention. In our experience, children who display frequent and intense reactivity may be struggling with more innate challenges related to sensory integration, attention and/or impulsivity, or mood disorders. Additionally, a history of trauma, a really difficult experience from the past, or relational mismatches between parent and child can play a role in behavioral struggles as they reveal an underlying challenge with self-regulation that may at times be a source of repeated ruptures in a relationship. We would encourage you to seek the help of someone who can help you walk through these questions and guide you and your child on the path toward optimal development. In most discipline situations with your child, though, simply taking a whole-brain approach will lead to more cooperation from your child and more peace and serenity in your household. 1-2-3 discipline isn't a formula or a set of rules to be strictly followed. You don't have to memorize it and inflexibly follow it. We're simply giving you guidelines to keep in mind when it comes time for redirection. By reminding yourself about the definition and purpose of discipline, the principles that should guide it, and your desired outcomes, you'll give yourself a much better chance of disciplining your kids, of teaching them, in a way that leads to more cooperation from them and better relationships among all members of the family.
Chapter 6, Addressing Behavior, as simple as redirect. Anna's 11-year-old, Paolo, called her from school and asked whether he could go home with his friend Harrison that afternoon. The plan, Paolo explained, was to walk to Harrison's, where the boys would do homework, then play until dinner. When Anna asked whether Harrison's parents were aware of the plan, Paolo assured her they were, so Anna told him she'd pick him up before dinner. However, when Anna texted Harrison's mother later that afternoon, telling her she'd be picking up Paolo in a few minutes, Harrison's mother revealed that she was at work. Anna then learned that Harrison's father hadn't been home either, and that neither of them knew of the boy's plan for Paolo to come over. Anna was mad. She knew there might have been some sort of miscommunication, but it really looked to her like Paolo had been dishonest. At best, he had misunderstood the plan, in which case he should have let her know when he realized that Harrison's parents wouldn't be home and hadn't been contacted. At worst, he had outright lied to her. Once she and Paolo were in the car on the way home from Harrison's, she felt like launching into him, leveling consequences and angrily lecturing him about trust and responsibility. But that's not what she did. Instead, she took a whole brain approach. Since her son was older and he wasn't in a reactive state of mind, the connect part of her approach simply entailed hugging him and asking whether he'd had a good time. Then she showed him the respect of communicating with him directly. She told him about her text with Harrison's mother, then said simply, "I'm glad you and Harrison have so much fun together, but I have a question. I know you know how important trust is in our family, so I'm wondering what happened here." She spoke in a calm tone, one that didn't communicate harshness, and instead expressed her lack of understanding and her curiosity about the situation. This curiosity-based approach, where she began by giving her son the benefit of the doubt, helped Anna decrease the drama from the discipline situation. Even though she was angry, she avoided immediately jumping to the conclusion that the boys had purposely deceived their parents. As a result, Paolo could hear his mother's question without feeling directly accused. Plus, her curiosity put the responsibility of accounting for himself squarely on Paolo's own shoulders, so he had to think about his decision-making, which gave his upstairs brain a little bit of exercise. Anna's approach showed Paolo that she worked from the assumption that he would make good decisions most of the time, and that she was confused and surprised when it appeared that he hadn't. In this case, by the way, he hadn't made good decisions. He explained to his mother that Harrison had thought his father would be home, but when the boys arrived, Harrison's father wasn't there. He acknowledged that he should have let her know right away, but he just hadn't. "I know, Mom. I should have told you nobody else was home. Sorry." Then Anna could respond and move from connection to redirection, saying something like, "Yes, I'm glad you're clear that you should have told me. Tell me more about why that didn't happen." But she knew she wanted her redirection to be about more than just addressing this one behavior. She rightly recognized this moment as another opportunity to build important personal and relational skills in her son, and to help him understand that his actions had made a little dent in her trust and deviated from their family agreement to always check in if plans change. That's why, before she turned to redirection, she checked herself. Before you redirect, keep calm and connect. Have you seen that British poster from World War II that's become so popular? The one that says, "Keep calm and carry on"? That's not a bad mantra to have at the ready when your child goes ballistic, or before you do. Anna recognized the importance of keeping calm when she addressed her problem with Paolo's behavior. Blowing up and yelling at her son wouldn't have done anyone any good. In fact, it would have alienated Paolo and become a distraction from what was important here. Using this disciplinary moment to address his behavior and to teach. We'll discuss many redirection strategies, looking at different ways to redirect children when they've made bad decisions or completely lost control of themselves. But before you decide on which redirection strategies to use as you redirect your kids toward using their upstairs brains, you should first do one thing. Check yourself. Remember, just as it's important to ask, "Is my child ready?" it's also essential that you ask, "Am I ready?" Imagine that you walk into your recently cleaned kitchen and find your 4-year-old perched on the counter, an empty egg carton and a dozen broken shells by her side, stirring a sand bucket full of eggs with her sand shovel. Or your 12-year-old informs you at 6 o'clock p.m. on Sunday that his 3D model of a cell is due the following morning. This, despite the fact that he assured you that all his homework was done, then spent the afternoon playing basketball and video games with a friend. In the middle of frustrating moments like these, the best thing you can do is to pause. Otherwise, your reactive state of mind might lead you to begin yelling or at least lecturing about the fact that a 4-year-old, or 12-year-old, ought to know better. Instead, pause. Just pause. Allow yourself to take a breath. Avoid reacting, issuing consequences, or even lecturing in the heat of the moment. We know it's not easy, but remember, when your kids have messed up in some way, you want to redirect them back toward their upstairs brain. So it's important to be in yours, too. When your 3-year-old is throwing a tantrum, remember that she's only a small child with a limited capacity to control her own emotions and body. Your job is to be the adult in the relationship and carry on as the parent, as a safe, calm haven in the emotional storm. How you respond to your child's behavior will greatly impact how the whole scene unfolds. So before you redirect, check yourself and do your best to keep calm. That's a pause that comes from the upstairs brain, but also reinforces the strength of your upstairs brain. Plus, when you show abilities like this to your children, they're more likely to learn such skills themselves. Staying clear and calm during a pause is your first step. Then, remember to connect. It really is possible to be calm, loving, and nurturing while disciplining your child. And it's so effective. Don't underestimate how powerful a kind tone of voice can be as you initiate a conversation about the behavior you're wanting to change. Remember that, ultimately, you're trying to remain firm and consistent in your discipline while still interacting with your child in a way that communicates warmth, love, respect, and compassion. These two aspects of parenting can and should coexist. That was the balance Anna tried to strike as she spoke with Paolo. As you've heard us affirm, kids need boundaries even when they're upset. But we can hold the line while providing lots of empathy and validation of the desires and feelings behind our child's behavior. You might say, "I know you really want another ice pop, but I'm not going to change my mind. It's okay to cry and be sad and disappointed, though, and I'll be right here to comfort you while you're sad." And remember not to dismiss a child's feelings. Instead, acknowledge the internal, subjective experience. When a child reacts strongly to a situation, especially when the reaction seems unwarranted and even ridiculous, the temptation for the parent is to say something like, "You're just tired," or, "It's not that big of a deal," or, "Why are you so upset about this?" But statements like these minimize the child's experience, her thoughts, feelings, and desires. It's much more emotionally responsive and effective to listen, empathize, and really understand your child's experience before you respond. Your child's desire might seem absurd to you, but don't forget that it's very real to him, and you don't want to disregard something that's important to him. So when it's time to discipline, keep calm and connect. Then you can turn to your redirection strategies. Strategies to help you redirect. For the remainder of this chapter, we'll focus on what you may have been waiting for. Specific, no-drama redirection strategies you can take once you've connected with your children and want to redirect them back to their upstairs brain. To help organize the strategies, we've listed them as an acronym. R, reduce words. E, embrace emotions. D, describe, don't preach. I, involve your child in the discipline. R, reframe a no into a conditional yes. E, emphasize the positive. C, creatively approach the situation. T, teach mindsight tools. Before we get into specifics, let us be clear. This isn't a list you need to memorize. These are simply categorized recommendations that the parents we've worked with over the years have found to be the most helpful. As always, you should keep all of these various strategies as different approaches in your parental toolkit, picking and choosing the ones that make sense in various circumstances, according to the temperament, age, and stage of your child, as well as your own parenting philosophy. Redirection strategy number one, reduce words. In disciplinary interactions, parents often feel the need to point out what their kids did wrong and highlight what needs to change next time. The kids, on the other hand, usually already know what they've done wrong, especially as they get older. The last thing they want, or usually need, is a long lecture about their mistakes. What a parent says? It's so important that you be responsible with your schoolwork because the effort you put in now will create habits for the future. Really, I can't stress it enough. Good habits are so important. They'll carry over into high school, then college, then your career and your marriage, and then what the child hears? Good habits, blah, 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 blah. We strongly suggest that when you redirect, you resist the urge to overtalk. Of course, it's important to address the issue and teach the lesson, but in doing so, keep it succinct. Regardless of the age of your children, long lectures aren't likely to make them want to listen to you more. Instead, you'll just be flooding them with more information and sensory input. As a result, they'll often simply tune you out. With younger children who may not have learned yet what's okay and what's not, it's even more important that we reduce our words. They often just don't have the capacity to take in a long lecture. So instead, we need to reduce our words. If your toddler, for instance, hits you because she's angry that she doesn't have your attention while you're attending to your other child, there's simply no reason to go off on a long, drawn-out oration about why hitting is a bad response to negative emotions. Instead, try this four-step approach that addresses the issue and then moves on, all without using more than a few words. Step 1. Connect and address the feelings behind the behavior. Oh, are you feeling frustrated? It's hard to wait sometimes. Step 2. Address the behavior. Hitting hurts. Step 3. Give alternatives. Be gentle with my body, please. Step 4, move on. Hey, let's go outside and see if those worms are still on the sidewalk. By addressing the child's actions and then immediately moving on, we avoid giving too much attention to the negative behavior and instead quickly get back on the right track. For younger and older kids both, avoid the temptation to talk too much when you discipline. If you do need to cover an issue more fully, try to do so by asking questions and then listening. As we'll explain, a collaborative discussion can lead to all kinds of important teaching and learning, and parents can accomplish their disciplinary goals without talking nearly as much as they typically do. The basic idea here is akin to the concept of saving your voice. Politicians, business people, community leaders, and anyone else who depends on effective communication to achieve their goals will tell you that often there are times when they strategically save their voice, holding back on how much they say. They don't mean their literal voice as if they'll make their throats hoarse by talking so much. They mean they try to resist addressing the small points in a discussion or a voting meeting so that their words will matter more when they want to address the really important issues. It's the same with our kids. If they hear us incessantly telling them what to do and what not to do, and then once we've made our point, we keep making it over and over again, they will sooner or later, and probably sooner, stop listening. If, on the other hand, we save our voice and address what we really care about, then stop talking, the words we use will carry much greater weight. Want your kids to listen to you better? Be brief. Once you address the behavior and the feelings behind the behavior, move on. Redirection strategy number 2, embrace emotions. One of the best ways to address misbehavior is to help kids distinguish between their feelings and their actions. This strategy is related to the concept of connection, but we're actually making a completely different point here. When we say to embrace emotions, we mean that during redirection, parents need to help their kids understand that their feelings are neither good nor bad, neither valid nor invalid. They simply are. There's nothing wrong with getting angry, being sad, or feeling so frustrated that you want to destroy something. But saying it's okay to feel like destroying something doesn't mean it's okay to actually do it. In other words, it's what we do as a result of our emotions that determines whether our behavior is okay or not okay. So our message to our children should be, you can feel whatever you feel, but you can't always do whatever you want to do. Another way to think about it is that we want to say yes to our kids' desires, even when we need to say no to their behavior and redirect them toward appropriate action. So we might say, I know you want to take the shopping cart home. That would be really fun to play with. But it needs to stay here at the store so other shoppers can use it when they come. Or we might say, I totally get it that you feel like you hate your brother right now. I used to feel that way about my sister when I was a kid and was really mad at her. But yelling, I'm going to kill you, isn't how we talk to each other. It's perfectly fine to be mad, and you have every right to tell your brother about it. But let's talk about other ways to express it. Say yes to the feelings, even as you say no to the behavior. When we don't acknowledge and validate our kids' feelings, or when we imply that their emotions should be turned off, or are no big deal, or silly, we communicate the message, I'm not interested in your feelings, and you should not share them with me. You just stuff those feelings right on down. Imagine how that impacts the relationship. Over time, our children will stop sharing their internal experiences with us. As a result, their overall emotional life will begin to constrict, leaving them less able to fully participate in meaningful relationships and interactions. Even more problematic is that a child whose parents minimize or deny her feelings can begin to develop what can be called an incoherent core self. When she experiences intense sadness and frustration, but her mother responds with statements like, relax, or you're fine, the child will realize, if only at an unconscious level, that her internal response to a situation doesn't match the external response from the person she trusts most. As parents, we want to offer what's called a contingent response, which means that we attune our response to what our child is actually feeling in a way that validates what's happening in her mind. If a child experiences an event and the response from her caregiver is consistent with it, if it's a match, then her internal experience will make sense to her, and she can understand herself, confidently name the internal experience, and communicate it to others. She'll be developing and working from a coherent core self. But what happens if that match isn't there, and her mother's response is inconsistent with the daughter's experience of the moment? One mismatch isn't going to have long-lasting effects. But if over and over again, when she gets upset, she is told something like, stop crying, or why are you so upset? Everyone else is having fun. She's going to begin to doubt her ability to accurately observe and comprehend what's going on inside her. Her core self will be much more incoherent, leaving her confused, full of self-doubt, and disconnected from her emotions. As she grows into an adult, she may often feel that her very emotions are unjustified. She might doubt her subjective experience and even have a hard time knowing what she wants or feels at times. So it really is crucial that we embrace our children's emotions and offer a contingent response when they are upset or out of control. One bonus to acknowledging our children's feelings during redirection is that doing so can help kids more easily learn whatever lesson we're wanting to teach. When we validate their emotions and acknowledge the way they are experiencing something, really seeing it through their eyes, that validation begins to calm and regulate their nervous system's reactivity. And when they are in a regulated place, they have the capacity to handle themselves.